Okay. All right. Well, we'll dive right in. I am Widget Walls from needcoffee.com, and we're recording this for posterity to eventually arrive on needcoffee.com. We're here in the Eagle Eye Bookshop here in Decatur, Georgia, with Ellie
Modisette,
thank you. And we're here to talk about his books and his writing and so forth and so on. So we'll start with just us having a little bit of a chat, and then we'll throw it open if anyone has any questions, and we'll just go from there. So first of all, I wanted to ask, I was looking on your website, and I saw what, in essence, your CV, where you have the various occupations that you've, Navy pilot and real estate agent and pretty much everything under the sun, other than, the only thing I think it was missing was like ninja and Area 51 consultant, although those may be classified and we may not be able to talk about them. But were you always looking to be a writer? Was that something that at six, when your peers wanted to be firemen and astronauts, you were like, no, I'm going to be a writer? Or is that something that came later?
That came later, actually, in my early teens. Mm. But I never was going to be a science fiction writer. Hmm. I was going to be a poet. And I wrote poetry, got it published in small literary magazines, probably from the time I was about 15 or 16. And kept writing it through college, through the time I was Navy pilot, mm-hmm. and for a couple of years thereafter. I have the probably unenviable distinction of having entered the Yale Younger Poet Contest every year until I was too old to be a younger poet, and only got form rejection letters.
Mm.
About that time, somebody suggested that, well, you've read science fiction ever since you were a kid. Why don't you try writing that?
Hmm.
So I wrote a science fiction story, and I sent it off to Ben Bova, who was then the editor of Analog, and he sent it back, and it said, this is not a bad story, but you made a terrible mess out of page 13. If you can fix it, I'll look at it again. I did. He bought it. I said, I'm a writer. No. I wrote 27 stories.
Hmm.
After that, before I sold the next one.
Wow.
And then I wrote about 17 after that, before I sold the third one.
Hmm.
And we kept whittling down the ratio of sales to rejections over the years. And I had sold about 7 or 8 stories over about that many periods, that many years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got another letter from Ben. And it literally said, don't send me any more stories. I won't buy them. And I sort of winced and didn't want to look at the verbiage that was below that, but I figured I'd better.
Right.
And it said, you are a novelist trying to cram novels into short stories. Go write a novel. And I did.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike the short stories, I've sold every novel I've ever written.
Wow.
So that's the short version.
Well, I have to ask, what exactly was the mess, if you recall, on page 13? It's a very specific note, so I'm just curious about.
Basically, it had to do with the economics of money creation. I'm an economist by training, and I didn't make it clear enough.
Ah.
The story was, and it's actually in my collection, Viewpoints Critical, the story was actually a forecasting of cybercrime before there was such a thing.
Hmm.
And the method that's in the story would actually work. It would still work.
Hence the consultancy that you just haven't been tapped to do yet, apparently.
Well, it would take a little doing, but it's technically feasible.
Hmm. So when you took his advice and wrote the novel, was it, indeed, if you were a novelist trying to cram things basically 6 pounds into a 1 pound bag, so to speak, did you find that it was liberating to have that room to stretch out, or was it easy to get into, or what was the transition like?
It was harder than hell. Because short stories, short fiction really has to almost turn on a dime. It's one of the reasons why it's hard to write. At least it's hard for me to write. I still do it. Novels, on the other hand, for the first three or probably the first, oh, maybe 10 novels I wrote,
right,
what I got back from the editors was always, you're being too cryptic. You need to expand this. And that makes sense given where I'd come from, because basically poetry is trying to say the most with the least number of words. Short stories are trying to say a bit more, but still trying to keep it very condensed. Whereas with a novel, your reader wants to know pretty much everything. And a lot of them want it explained very thoroughly. And I still tend on some things to be elliptical.
Now, is that why you started writing the series of books that you did? Because you said, oh, well, if you want expansion, I'll give you expansion.
No, that had nothing to do with it. I won't tell the exact story on that because it would take way longer than we have. But basically, I had written about, I guess it was about six or seven science fiction books. And my editor called me up, and I was working in D.C., and he basically said, you need to go to a convention. Now, I didn't come into writing from the convention side. I came in it from the purely technical side. Never been to a convention, only knew that they existed. And I went to a convention, and I ended up on a panel with a bunch of fantasy writers, and I realized, should we say, was made to realize forcibly that most of them didn't know squat about economics and politics in real worlds. And I thought I could write a fantasy that basically used real-world economics, real-world politics, and had a logical magic system, which is not something that the field, now you got to remember, this was over 20 years ago, and authors have gotten a whole lot better in that period of time. But at that time, you still had people writing fantasies with 20,000 armed knights on a side, and that doesn't work. And if you really want to know why, I'll tell you, but let's just say it doesn't work.
You're the expert. We'll take your word for it. Going back in that direction in a second, but to back up a bit, you were a poet that read science fiction. Now, when someone suggested, try writing science fiction, were there any particular authors that you looked to kind of not be a template, but maybe an inspiration is a better word, or?
No, I can't say that. I'd say that there were so many that I probably couldn't pin anyone down, because I was a really voracious reader at that particular point. Unlike a lot of people, my mother was the actual inspiration for science fiction. She was a voracious reader of science fiction at a time when most women didn't. And it was really very simple. We lived a long ways from any libraries and from any bookstores, and she had this rather large bookcase of paperback science fiction. And loving books and being lazy, it didn't take me long to figure out that, boy, it was all right there.
Wow. So if it had been a less genre fiction, you would be writing the quote unquote non-genre great American novels now, or would you have? Do you think you would have always wound up at science fiction fantasy?
That's hard to say. I might have wound up with mysteries. I mean, there's an element of mystery in most of my science fiction, and even a lot of my fantasy. In that sense, I sort of crush genres anyway.
Leaping back forward again, you were hitting on something that I really wanted to ask you about, which is something that fascinates me about writing, is the whole world-building aspect of it. I am just fascinated by that, everything from, the fact that Frank Herbert's Dune had the appendices, basically, that seemed to say, well, I had all this world-building stuff that I couldn't put in the book, so let me just put these in the appendix so they don't go to waste. And then you have stuff more recently like George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire. So I love good world-building, so I know what you're talking about there. Is there a process that you go through to kind of put that together? Are you taking huge sheets of paper and sketching things out? Is it all in your head? How does that process start for you?
Most of it's in my head, and most of it's simply because of the background that I had. started out, as I mentioned before, as an economist.
Right.
Was a military pilot. Got involved in, well, I came back and became an industrial economist for a little while. And then I got involved in real estate. And then I got involved in politics. And then I got involved in more politics. And then I got involved after that in being a consultant to some of the largest corporations in the country on environmental and energy matters. And it just, all of those pieces are simply there because you see when you've had that range of occupations how they all intertwine. And I mean, basically, yes, I have to sort of ask the questions when I'm putting together a new culture, a new thing. And the key question is probably different is, all right, how will a magic system affect the economics, the political structures, and what have you? In some ways, it's not all that different from fantasy to fantasy because human beings have one, call it basic trait, that sometimes gets overlooked in fantasy, and that is we're tool users. Anything that can be made into a tool, we will. And magic would be no different if it happened to be real. So I take that into account in developing things because the question is going to be, how are people going to be able to use this? What are they going to do with it? Because they are certainly going to do something with it. And if they can't, they're going to discard it and it's going to become a backwater. And we also are very economic beings in the sense that everything has to be paid for in some way or another. So magic's going to have to be integrated into the economic system.
No such thing as a free lunch.
Well, it's not so much that there's no such thing as a free lunch. It's that nobody is going to do anything for nothing.
Interesting. Now, the other thing about, I guess, a process-related question would be, seeing as how you have written and had published so many books, when you are... There's the process in your head talking about the questions that you ask for world building. When it comes to, shall we call it, book building, I was just wondering if you could speak a bit about your process for how you begin to, you know, attack a book. Some people outline it. Some people have it all in their head. I mean, what is your particular approach?
A little of each in the sense that I have a general concept of what I'm going to do, how I want to do it. But what I tend to outline is, in essence, the structure of the society, the culture, the magic system, the political institutions, the religious institutions, and, of course, my map. Every fantasy universe I've done, I've had the map. Now, some of those haven't shown up until later in the books, but I've had them from the beginning. And I draw them to scale because I got really irritated when I was a reader when I discovered that... In certain fantasy books, somebody was making a journey on horseback, and it was 3 days in this book, and it was 8 days in this book, and the weather didn't change. And I thought, wait a second here. So if I make it to scale, I can always keep myself fairly on track. And I also... especially in the later books, actually keep a calendar of the events in every chapter. That never gets published, but...
So you have time and space basically nailed down to keep yourself from making those mistakes four books later down the line. For those people who might be listening to this later, time-shifted, there were grins and approval from the audience about wanting to keep that under wraps. So well played that. So would it be safe to say if you've got that going into the creation of the world and all the structures and so forth, do you then sort of, for lack of a better way of putting it, wind up the characters and put them into the framework and see what happens, or with an eye towards where they're supposed to go? Or
not exactly. I think I know for the most part what my characters are like, and I know where they're going to get. What I don't always know is precisely the tiny details of how they're going to get there. Because that depends on the interplay of all of the characters until you actually Well, it's sort of like building a steam engine, if you will, or any piece of machinery. Yes, you've got the concept. You know how you think. You know how all of the pieces are going to fit together. When you finally machine it and put it together, you may have to make a few tweaks and adjustments here, or it's not going to work. Well, I think in that sense, you can make the analogy to writing. You may have the concept. You may have it all set together, but you very well are going to have to do some tweaking as you go along.
Yeah, that's the part that I always find fascinating, is the bits that you don't know going in or that you surprise yourself with that you have to then figure out.
The biggest thing I think that I've ever had is you occasionally come to the point where you realize that a given character is not going to do what you had in mind because that character that you've developed wouldn't do it that way.
And for me, even more so than time and space, it really irritates me when the author wants to make a character's actions, shall we say, inorganic to what they would do. Kind of the hand of God pushing them somewhere.
Well, that's a real danger with what we would call a plot-driven book. Plot-driven books often suffer from the problem of the author wanting the characters to do something that the characters would not necessarily do. On the other hand, character-driven books often suffer from the problem of not having much of a plot because you get so involved in the characters. And it's really a balancing act to make sure that the plot and the characters mesh all the way through.
One of the other things I saw, changing gears a little bit, I saw on your website was people were constantly interested in the electronic versions of your work being available. And it seems like from your responses to them that you're very pleased to have the majority of your stuff in these various new mediums, ebooks and Kindles and so forth. Does this, as an author looking at the various new ways besides, shall we say, dead tree versions of publishing that things can become available, is that are you pleased about these various new mediums? Do you have any fears about them? What is your take on it?
I think, as with all new technologies, the whole idea of ebooks, Kindles, and what have you is going to have its advantages and it's going to have its disadvantages. From the strictly economic point of view, there's going to be quite a shakeout in this because we've seen over the last 15 years that, in general, paperback book sales have just about halved for every author. I mean, there are exceptions among the mega million sellers, but in general, I mean, there are some very big authors who've seen this happen, and I'm talking much bigger than I am, who've seen significant losses in revenue because of the loss of paperback book sales. In general, we will tend to make a bit more, and this is a generalization because it varies by genre, publisher, reputation, you name it. But you'll generally make just a bit more on an ebook version of something than on a paperback. You will also make probably, well, I won't give specific percentages, but not insignificantly less on an ebook version of a hardcover. So how this all sorts out is still very much in flux at this stage of the game. I think the greater problem I see with the move to electronics, though, is that an awful lot of the younger generation are moving toward reading things far more briefly. And they get very impatient. Not all of them, by any stretch of the imagination, but a number of them get very impatient with things which they feel move slowly. And if you look at, say, Amazon reader reviews of books that have been around 15 years, because that's about as far back as the reader reviews go, you'll find that initially there were very few reviews out there of anybody's books that said boring, slow, etc. You look at current reviews, and there's a tremendous amount more of this, a great deal of impatience, and most of it's from what looked to be younger readers. And I think this is going to play into the book field over the years to come. How much and to what degree, I don't know. But I think there's going to be increasing pressure to make things move faster. And that's not just ebook, that's a whole cultural trend. If you look at TV, for example, they use a lot of time reduction tricks in TV production. They'll basically cut out half seconds here and there, seconds here and there, speed up the dialogue just imperceptibly to move things along. You've got a generation that has got wants things to move fast. The danger with that is the faster you move, often the less you think. And I'm talking in a deeper sense. And I worry very much about some of these young people because I don't think they are thinking. And the other problem with that is that they're losing interpersonal skills. I've noticed in a lot of the business articles right now, one of the biggest drawbacks for young people who are going out for jobs is they don't have interpersonal skills. They can't read body language. They don't present themselves verbally very well. They often don't dress well. This is comes from a generation that's doing all of its communicating, or a tremendous percentage of it, electronically. Now, there's nothing wrong with electronic communications per se, but when it dominates things to the fact where you lose personal communication skills, that's dangerous. The other thing that's dangerous about this is, and I haven't seen much on this, but if you can't read people, you become more susceptible to being conned by whoever it may be. And we're seeing, again, a return to simplistic, incredibly simplistic messages in politics, in advertising, and what have you. And if you read my books, I'm not big on simplistic, because simplistic almost always leads to disaster. Now, that's a really long answer to your question.
It's interesting because it's the absolute right person to ask is the writer who's also trained as an economist. So so that's excellent. The other thing I find that's interesting about books not moving fast enough is I'm a big audiobook listener myself, since I scarcely have time, sadly, to sit and read something these days. But that way, when you're reading, of course, you have a tendency to want to skip ahead, because especially if you want to know what comes next. But with the audiobook, you're stuck at the pace of the reader, which sometimes is helpful as well. One of the other things I wanted to ask you was, I've seen that with like the success of, going back to George R. R. Martin, that we have Game of Thrones on television now, which has made a big splash and won awards and so forth. I have a theory that if not at the moment, then it's happening, that we're going to see Hollywood television and film and whatnot kind of looking around various places to see what could be the next Game of Thrones. Because, of course, nobody wants to be first, but once there's a bit of success, they want to do the next thing. So has there been anything going on with you that you can even speak of in regards to film, television, stage musicals, anything regarding your works?
I'm going to answer that question very indirectly. it doesn't make sense if I try and answer it directly.
That's fine.
I tend to write things for people who like to think, whether they're 13-year-old bright kids who like to think or 80-year-old PhDs. And my readers literally span that gamut. Consequently, much of what I write is really hard for Hollywood to digest, and I'm going to tell you a story about that.
Oh, lovely. I love stories.
Probably about 15 years ago, I wrote a book called an Enigma. And I got a letter in the mail from an outfit called Lightstorm Entertainment.
Okay.
And at the time, I didn't know who Lightstorm Entertainment was, because it was just signed by a development director.
Right.
Who I didn't know either. But I found who it was, and I'll leave that for a little bit. And I called them up and said, okay, what is this? And they basically said, well, we're very interested in this. Nothing happened. nothing happened. And finally I figured, well, it's dead, but I just want to know why.
Hmm.
So I called them back and said, well, I assume it's dead, but why? And they said, well, we all liked it, but James thought it was too complicated for him. James Cameron, the head of Lightstorm.
Hmm. Yes.
I have had three options to make a computer game out of the Recluse series.
Hmm.
Every single developer ended up not exercising the option they paid for because they decided it was too complicated for them. I've had a feeler from a Hollywood type just in the past month or so about possibly turning my Ghost series into a television series, which would be probably termed modernistic steampunk.
Mm.
Because that series literally fits in that genre. Whether anything will come of it, I don't know. But I have my doubts, simply because Hollywood isn't that interested in making people think, and that's what I do best.
Mm. Which is funny, because that is very true, in that there are so many television shows that are extremely popular that require no thought whatsoever. The fact that Real Housewives of anything is a franchise, or that there's, I was absolutely horrified to find that there were competing cake shows on different networks. But yet we find that the ones that become extremely successful these days, like Game of Thrones or Walking Dead or even Lost, actually require some engagement on a mental level to be able to keep up with what's going on.
But it depends on what kind of mental engagement you're talking about.
That's true.
I mean, if you're talking about Game of Thrones, and I'll be honest, I've read some of the books, but I have not seen the series.
Mm.
But having read the books, it's more like a mental juggling match is to figure out who's doing what to whom when.
True enough. Fair enough.
As opposed to thinking about, why are they doing this in the deeper sense? What does this mean for society? What does this mean for ethics?
Mm.
What does this mean for politics? And that's probably the difference between George and me.
Mm.
I mean, I do have some books with a cast of thousands as opposed to his millions, but...
Fair enough. All right. One last question, and then we'll see if you guys here in the audience have any questions. I wanted to ask, because you are such a prolific writer, there are so many writers who it really takes them a lot of work to sit down and work, or they have problems with writer's block or things like that to try to get in their way. Do you experience this, and if so, how do you deal with it, or is it simply a process by which, because this is what you do, you have it down to an art and/or/science.
I'm going to quote or misquote the British author Terry Pratchett.
Ah.
Terry is reputed to have said, writer's block is a singular American affectation. And I agree with him.
Mm.
Basically, you wouldn't go to a doctor who had doctor's block.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't want your kids taught by a teacher who had teacher's block. You wouldn't want a dentist drilling your teeth who had dentist block.
Mm-hmm.
Why in the hell do you think writers can have this idea of, oh, I've got writer's block, I can't write? I'm not saying that you don't get stuck at things.
Mm.
I mean, I wrote a book once, and it was Gravity Dreams. And I got halfway through the book, and I thought, this is not working. Okay.
Mm.
I didn't agonize over it. I didn't say, oh, woe is me, I can't write. I put the thing on the back shelf and wrote two more books, and then by the time I'd written two more books, I came back and figured out how I was going to finish it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a professional, whatever it is, you do that profession.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our job is not to be inspired. Our job is to inspire.
Mm, I love that. I wish I could, I'll say this by way of return, I wish I could remember the agent who told the story, but there was an agent, a literary agent, who would get writers who would come in and say, listen, is there any way that I can get some kind of advance just to tide me over because I'm having this horrible writer's block and I don't know what to do about it. And he would say, all right, I'll tell you what. I can do that. Here's what I'd like you to do for me, though. I'd like you to go into the next room. There's a typewriter in there. And I'd like you to just sit down and write something, could be anything, that you think is worth what you want the advance to be. And we can work out the advance, no problem. So they'd go into the next room, and a few hours later, they'd come out with some papers, sheepishly, and leave. I need to go back and figure out which agent said that, because I do so love that story, because it's so very true. It's something that you can work through or work around or do anything, but just saying that I'm blocked and I can't do it. I love that dentist's block. I'll have to remember that. All right, so does anyone here have any questions for us?
I'd be interested in knowing if you have any particular notion of how you put together relationships between men and women. I've always been struck by that in some of your books. I really enjoy some of that interplay.
That interplay is the result of the failures in my life. I mean, it's no secret. I've been married 3 times. The first 2 times for 11 years. Thankfully, I finally found somebody who I could work it out with, and Carol Ann and I have been married 20 years, and I have no intention of giving her up for anything. I also have 8 children. 6 of them are mine, 2 of them are Carol Ann's, and 6 daughters. And when you have 6 daughters, you learn about personal interplay very quickly, especially when they're teenagers. As a matter of fact, I did use some of their interplay, particularly in the 2 last books in the Corian Chronicles, The Lord Protector's Daughter and Lady Protector, because the main characters are 3 sisters. And I won't say they're modeled, but I did use some of the interplay between my older daughters as a basis for the interplay between those 3 sisters.
Write what you know.
Well,
or make up the rest.
That's actually true of pretty much all that I've written. Mm. I mean, I have tried to stick to the things that I know about. If you look at, for example, the space combat that I've done, it's no accident that I was a helicopter pilot. Helicopter pilots are one of the few pilots that actually have to think in 3 dimensions.
Hmm.
Space piloting is in 3 dimensions.
I love it. The science fiction fantasy writing makes more and more sense the longer I sit here. Other questions? Anyone? Yeah.
So you were talking earlier about how your different occupations as an economist and a politician and all this informed your writing. Have you found that to any extent your writing was informing those other occupations as well? Or was it influencing your other careers?
It might have if I had kept up with the other careers. I kept the day job for almost 30 years after I got out of college. Part of that is if you have a lot of children, you really do need a dedicated income, at least until they get out of college. But I don't know how you separate it, because one of my traits which has proved useful is I love information.
Hmm.
I read nonfiction, science magazines, pretty much cover to cover, economics publications. I still keep up with that. I used to even take the Physics Journal of the American Physics Society until I realized that, yeah, I was reading the words, but I really wasn't understanding all of the abstruse theory. So I have to rely a little bit on the Scientific American and New Scientist and some other fairly good publications which do the translations for me. But I still try and keep up with that. And I don't know, I just, as I said, I love information, so I just keep reading it.
You never know when what might come in handy at a certain point.
Well, as a writer, you have to do research. The only question is how you do it.
Hmm.
And I prefer the method of continually researching and then mining what I've discovered.
Hmm.
as opposed to the specific researching on a specific thing. Now, occasionally, you do have to research specific things, and sometimes you find out that, well, for example, our wonderful World Wide Web is terribly unuseful in finding out certain things. I mean, I once wanted to find out the layout of an 1850s steel mill because I was writing about a primitive steel mill in, as a matter of fact, Magegard of Hamor. And I really wanted to know how the mills were set up. It took forever to find that kind of information. It's not the sort of thing that people keep around.
Although it's it's interesting. How, out of curiosity, how long ago was that, give or take, that you were looking for that? Not last week, I assume.
6 or 7 years ago.
Okay. Yeah. What I have found is that as time increases, there's some sort of law where as we get further and further into the internet, the chances of there being a devoted website to everything, including, I would think, 1850 steel mills, increases, because you still can't find it?
Nope. I occasionally check on these sorts of things.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant.
No, so, there's certain things that, I mean, the web is very, shall we say, user, not just user-friendly, but user-derived, user-developed.
Mm.
And if people aren't interested in this sort of thing, it's not going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems with the web is that I find it, for the most part, unless you have either an incredible public library that you can go through to do this, or a university that you can go through, finding detailed information beyond what I would call the top 40 on anything is extremely difficult. You really have to go into other people's libraries, and most libraries are not available online unless you've got a university connection and what have you. I mean, my wife, for example, would love to have, she's a professor of music, she'd love to have the Groves Library, which is the Bible of musicians. She'd love to have that for her department. They can't afford it. They're a university. They can't afford the license for the best musical. And it's not that, you know, they certainly have to watch their pennies, but it's that expensive. And when people talk about the web in the abstract, they're talking about, well, this is what's theoretically there. Theoretically doesn't count. Practical is what counts. Can you get to it? And we once did a survey on composers. And basically, you can find probably 100 different citations on Mozart, for example, maybe thousands of them. And they all have the same three paragraphs. As Mark Twain said, well, I'm comparing it. The internet is sort of like what Mark Twain said about the Platte River. It's 3 miles wide and 12 inches deep. And the internet's pretty much the same way unless you've got these particular subscriptions and availabilities.
Right. Going back to what you said about theoretically, it reminds me of the quote about in theory there is no difference between theory and practice, but in practice there is. although I'd like to point out to anyone listening that if you have been wondering about a particular niche to start a blog on, apparently 1850s steel mills is wide open. So just take that home with you. Any other questions?
Are you going to be doing another Intangible Ghosts series?
There is a short story set in that universe in my collection, Viewpoints Critical. I have an open invitation from my editor to write more books in that series, although they would not be a continuation of Johann and Lisette because their story ends. They said I could write a prequel about Johann when he is an active intelligence officer. I have deferred doing that for a lot of reasons, and I won't close that door, but it's not going to happen anytime soon. For a lot of personal reasons, my wife has been very sick this year. I lost about 4 months of the year from writing, and this is actually the first tour I've been on in like 8 months, and that includes conventions that I had to cancel. So I'm a little bit behind. I have to finish the fourth book in the Imager subseries that I'm now working on. I have a commitment to write a science fiction novel for Tor after that, and a less firm commitment to write a Recluse novel after that. So it's going to be another year or so before I can think about other projects.
Mm. Okay. Do you have any other questions? Okay. Well, just to wrap up, because I know you're here promoting your latest book, for those people who cannot be here with us who are listening from the website, I was wondering if you could give them a quick overview of the latest book so that they know what they need to go grab.
Well, I'm going to make it a little larger than that.
Please, feel free.
Scholar is the fourth book in the Imager portfolio. Mm. The first three books are about a character by the name of Renthal, and they take place in a universe which has a technology roughly equivalent to 1850-1860, except it does not have electricity. I mean, theoretically it could, it's just that the culture didn't develop with electromagnetics as early as ours did. Mm. Or perhaps they came up with metallurgy and steam earlier. But it does have one element of magic. Very, very few people can image, if you will, visualize and rearrange matter. Hmm. But it's a recessive gene. There's only about 1.5 million people who can do it. They're called imagers. Well, in Renthal's time, he's an artist who discovers late in life, comparatively, that he is an imager. And the first three books are about him. Scholar, which is the book that just came out this week, takes place some 600 years before that. And it's during the time when the continent, which later became the land of Solidar, is still divided into five warring nations. And it features a young scholar who has kept secret the fact that he's an imager, because imagers have a tendency in this culture to get killed very young. Hmm. And it's basically the story of, if you will, how he discovers that in good conscience he cannot keep his imaging hidden, and how he's trying to minimize it as much as possible while pursuing, shall we say, somewhat ideological and altruistic goals while trying to stay alive, all of which are almost mutually incompatible.
Mm. Fascinating. And that is
Scholar.
Yes, fantastic. Okay. All right. Well, that concludes that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.